It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here with a couple of fun photos. Two pictures of the week. Well, a cartoon and a picture. How processors are made. Oh, that's exciting. We also have a look at a new exploit that is unfixable on modern hardware. It's the side-channel MMU attack. Well, we'll find out what that is. Get your propellers and your propeller hats ready. It's time for a geek-out episode of Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte, and once again, time for TWiT's audience survey. We'd really like to hear from you. It's only going to take a couple of minutes, really. That's all. Just go to twit.tv/survey and let us know what you think. Your anonymous feedback will help us make TWiT even better. And thanks for your continued support. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 600, recorded Tuesday, February 21st, 2017, the MMU side channel attack. Security Now is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software used by over 10 million small business owners. Try it free for 30 days. FreshBooks.com/securitynow. And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 200-plus job boards, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter free at ZipRecruiter.com/twit. And by IT Pro TV, an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the lifetime of your account. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security and privacy online with the explainer in chief himself. Look, I can hold his head in my hand. Steve Gibson is here from the Gibson Research Corporation. I'm actually virtually holding your head in my hand. Steve joins us via Skype each week to talk the latest security news. And today, something, an exploit. You like to talk about exploits,
yes.
Right?
So, first of all, episode 600.
Oh, wow. I forgot.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that
600.
We're doing almost exactly 52 a year with a few exceptions.
Yep.
So this is our, that can't be right, 12th year?
You know, and it's going to really foul me up if we have to go to four digits. So I think we ought to just plan on 999.
We'll stop in 8 years. That'll be it. It'll be over.
I think we'll be done. We'll be fried by that point.
We'll be in our late 60s. There'll be a new president 8 years from now.
Probably the case.
All likelihood. Yeah.
That's true.
Life will be very changed. I mean, imagine what we've seen in 8 years of technology evolution. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, during the 12 years of this podcast, we've seen, we've gone from the quaint little, email macros.
Honey monkeys. Or what was it?
Yeah. Right.
Melissa.
To what we're going to discuss today is yet another piece of sublime engineering from our friends at who are led by Professor Herbert Boss at the University of Amsterdam. They're the people who gave us flip feng shui and DRAMer, and they've figured out how to, in JavaScript in a browser, leverage the innate functioning of the memory management hardware, which is present in all contemporary CPU architectures, in order to robustly break address space layout randomization.
ASLR. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So anyway, so this is you may be able to walk and chew gum at the same time, but you're not going to be able to listen to this podcast, the latter half of this podcast, and walk and chew gum. So choose two out of those three.
This is what we call a propeller hat
This is going to be, yes, we're going to lose some people. I don't want to, and I'll take this easy.
Take it as a challenge, my friends. Can you continue to listen to this show?
Yeah, so stop chewing or stop walking. You know, maybe this is where you put your car on auto drive, because boy, this is going to take it. This is going to need everything you've got, but I think everyone's going to enjoy it. And we have a bunch of interesting news. We've got Microsoft's February patch Tuesday changed from delayed to entirely canceled amid a flurry of serious problems. They updated saying, we're not even going to do it this month. Wait till March.
They canceled it?
They completely canceled it. So, I mean, it's not because there wasn't anything in need of fixing. There's like some serious problems. We got the SMB zero-day flaw still out there flapping in the breeze, and a couple other things that we'll talk about today. It turns out that it's not only laptop webcams that we need to worry about. A really interesting story, actually from an IBMer through the RSA conference, about the perils of purchasing a previously owned internet-connected auto. Chrome has changed. Yes. Chrome 56 changed its UI, making certificate inspection more difficult. We've got a workaround for that, at least for Windows. I don't know if it works on other platforms. Some news about the future of Firefox add-ons, which is a definitely mixed blessing. It turns out that Windows 10s and also 8.1's lock screen is leaking the system's clipboard data, and Microsoft says they don't care. There's a collection of new problems for Windows, an amazing free crypto book online from Stanford and New York University professors that we'll talk about, some quick follow-ups to pfSense and Ubiquiti that we've been talking about recently, a fun bit of geek humor, so a little bit of miscellany, and then a deep dive into yet another sublime hack from our ever clever friends from the University of Amsterdam, who are, you know, that team that Herbert Boss leads. This just came out of, actually it came out of it went public last Tuesday, and just totally ate up my Twitter feed. All of the press got it wrong, of course, because as I said, this is a wind up your propeller. So we'll talk about that. And so many people were tweeting, say, do you know about this? Do you know about this? And it's like, yeah, I haven't been able to say anything about it because it was embargoed until they made news. And so I've been waiting to talk about it because, again, it's just, wow, another beautiful piece of work. So I think we've got a great 2 hours for our listeners.
Wow. All right. Very interesting stuff. We're going to get to that in a moment. But first, a word from our sponsor, FreshBooks. These are folks that help a small business person. And I don't mean by that somebody who's height challenged. I mean somebody whose business is small, maybe just them, small enough that you probably don't have a full-time bookkeeper, small enough that maybe you're the one sending out invoices and keeping track of where the money is, what you're spending. Is that you? Then you're going to want to know about FreshBooks. I actually started using FreshBooks myself many moons ago. Amber MacArthur told me about it in 2004. They had just started up, and I was bemoaning, you know, the monthly ritual at the end of the month of sending out invoices. I had to invoice Rogers in Toronto for the, you know, the show, for my expenses and all that stuff. And it was in Canadian dollars, and it was just firing up Excel and doing the whole thing. And I'd put it off, and she said, no. You know, this is, you put it off, you put off getting paid. You got to know about FreshBooks. This is how long ago this was. She said, it's one of those Web 2.0 sites. Well, it's come a long way, baby. Web 2.0 in the sense that it's an application, but you use your browser to access it, completely secure, of course. And the front page, the dashboard, is everything you need to know how you're doing in your business. It starts with the invoices. Great invoices, easy to make fast to create that. And I have that direct experience of that, which just took all the pain out of it. They handle every currency. They even, the invoices you send, they even have a pay me now button, which means that your clients can use online payment services or credit cards to pay you, which means you get paid a lot faster because the clients want to get this over with too. On average, 11 days faster. And look, you didn't get into business because you wanted to be a bookkeeper, unless your business is bookkeeping. But you probably got into business because you're doing something you enjoy. And the books are just kind of the afterthought, the thing you don't really want to do so much. Well, 10 million people have discovered FreshBooks.com. Tracking expenses is as easy as taking a photo of the receipt using the FreshBooks app on your smartphone. It goes right into the FreshBooks dashboard. And because you're keeping track of invoices, accounts receivable, expenses, you're assigning expenses to projects and clients, you can bill time and hours. It'll automatically track both. You know where you stand. For a lot of small business owners, FreshBooks is the first time they've ever known whether they're making a profit before tax time, before they got their tax return back. Did I make a profit this year? Oh, let's open the envelope and see. Over $60 billion in invoices have been paid through FreshBooks, and frankly, this is how you should be doing it too. It'll simplify your life, and the brand new FreshBooks dashboard is stellar. Go to FreshBooks.com/security now and sign up for a free, unlimited 30-day trial. You can really get a sense of it. It's unrestricted. 30 days free. FreshBooks.com/security now. And do me a favor, when they ask you, how did you hear about us, cast your vote for Security Now by just saying, I heard it on Security Now. That would really help. FreshBooks.com/security now. Leo Laporte, Steve Gibson. Let's hit the week's news. I guess that's next.
Well, we do have our picture of the week.
Of course we do.
Which is a fun little cartoon. It shows a married couple, a husband and wife. He's in front of his laptop, and she's sort of looking over his shoulder. And he says in the caption, "Of course this website is safe. Huh. As an extra measure of security, they make you sign in with your social security number, mother's name, your bank account, home address, phone number, and date of birth.
What could go wrong?
How could a bad guy ever find out all those things? You know? So, of course it's secure.
Yeah.
That's right. So,
and then they store it for
yeah.
future reference.
That's right. Just to make sure you don't change anything. So, as we mentioned at the top of the show, the February 2017 security update was formally canceled. In an update that Microsoft Security posted later that Tuesday, when we referred to it a week ago, they formally said, update on 2/15. So it was Wednesday, the day after. We will deliver updates as part of the planned March update Tuesday, March 14th, 2017. So don't be holding your breath, anybody. I'd had it on my mind because I know that there are so many significant pending issues. And the presumption was that, well, in fact, they originally said that, they were a little obscure. It was like, something has just recently come to our attention that we need to deal with, so we're going to, be delaying the update. Well, yeah, a month. And actually, it may have been just the fact that they've established this monthly cycle, that there's too much blowback, even at the expense of delaying a fix for something important. Too much blowback about an out-of-cycle patch. That they said, well, it's going to upset too much of corporate customers for us to just drop this thing a week or two late. So we're just going to stay with the plan, stay with the normal Patch Tuesday cycle. I mean, because I imagine they must have these problems fixed by now, but they must have decided it's too much of a problem for us to do it out of cycle.
I mean, we don't know, obviously.
We don't know.
Yeah. They haven't said.
Some of these problems are just, they're not difficult to fix. I can't figure out what's going on. So there's a U.S.-based industrial cybersecurity firm named CyberX Labs in Framingham, Massachusetts. Their blog disclosed the results of some of their research, which was interesting. Their posting was titled CyberX Discovers Large-Scale Cyber Reconnaissance Operation Targeting Ukrainian Organizations. And in their blog, they wrote, CyberX has discovered a new large-scale cyber reconnaissance operation targeting a broad range of targets in the Ukraine. And it was funny, too, because I think I heard you, Leo, talking about Ukraine versus the Ukraine.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah.
You know,
they don't like Ukraine anymore.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, so I'm trying to say Ukraine, not the Ukraine.
It's hard. We've been trained for years to say the Ukraine.
Yes.
And, but you don't say Italy or the France.
Precisely. Or the America.
Right.
But we do say the United States.
Oh.
So I was sort of wondering if somehow its history of the Ukraine is like connected to the United States.
I think it's connected to the Soviet Union and not right. wanting to be seen as a region of the Soviet Union, but instead a whole country.
Right. So anyway, I was self-conscious about the use of the throughout their blog posting. And I thought before I realized they were in the U.S., I thought, oh, well, maybe this is a definitive non-U.S. biased source of where the should be used.
I have been told in no uncertain terms there's no the there.
Interesting.
Ukraine.
So range of targets in Ukraine.
Yes.
Is what it should say, not the Ukraine.
That's correct.
In Ukraine. Okay. Well, so forgive me for any thus that are in their blog posting, okay. But I didn't put them there.
We'll send them a letter.
It's good to know that definitively no more the.
Right.
So they say, because it eavesdrops on sensitive conversations, and here's the point, one of the most scary factors, by remotely controlling PC microphones in order to surreptitiously bug its targets, and uses Dropbox to store exfiltrated data, CyberX has named it Operation Bug Drop. CyberX has confirmed, they write, at least 70 victims successfully targeted by the operation in a range of sectors, including critical infrastructure, media, and scientific research. The operation seeks to capture a range of sensitive information from its targets, including audio recordings of conversations, screenshots, documents, and passwords. So this is a comprehensive Trojan of some sort. Unlike video recordings, which are often blocked by users simply placing tape over the camera lens, it is virtually impossible to block your computer's microphone without physically accessing and disabling the PC hardware, which, as we know, is true. Maybe disable the media driver, you know, the hardware level driver to access the microphone, but that's not obvious. And, you know, covering the microphone hole, if you can even find it, with a piece of tape, well, that might muffle the audio a bit, but it's not like blocking it the way you can sticking tape over the camera. So they said most of the targets are located in the Ukraine, but there are also targets in Russia, but not the Russia, and a smaller number of targets in Saudi Arabia and Australia. Many targets are located in the self-declared separatist states of
Don't look at me for help, buddy.
Donetsk and Luhansk, which have been classified as terrorist organizations.
I believe that's the Donetsk and Luhansk.
I think so. By the Ukrainian government. CyberX is keeping the identities of the affected organizations private, but they give us a high-level peek, saying examples of Operation Bug Drop targets identified by CyberX so far include a company that designs remote monitoring systems for oil and gas pipeline infrastructures, an international organization that monitors human rights, counterterrorism, and cyber attacks on critical infrastructure in the Ukraine, a scientific research institute, an engineering company that designs electrical substations, gas distribution pipelines, and water supply plants, and editors of Ukrainian newspapers. So, you know, this really does sound, we don't have any reason to believe it's Russian-backed, but it sure seems like it might be. Operation Bug Drop, they write, is a well-organized operation that employs sophisticated malware and appears to be backed by an organization with substantial resources. In particular, the operation requires a massive back-end infrastructure to store, decrypt, and analyze several gigabytes per day of unstructured data that is being captured from its targets. A large team of human analysts is also required to manually sort through captured data, like listen to all of that, and process it manually and/or with big data-like analytics. Initially, CyberX saw similarities between Operation Bug Drop and a previous cyber surveillance operation discovered by ESET in May 2016 called Operation Groundbait. However, despite some similarities in the tactics, techniques, and procedures, we have a new acronym, TTPs, Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures, used by the hackers in both operations, Operation Bug Drop's TTPs are significantly more sophisticated than those used in the earlier operation. And they go into some additional details that leads us to, I mean, they're like, there are connections to Dooku and Stuxnet and, you know, high-level work. So no clear attribution for this, but a serious, persistent campaign that was discovered by these guys. So props to them. And it's just nice, even though it's not affecting us and there's nothing we can do about it, it's sobering to recognize that this kind of high-budget, large data-focused campaign is present, probably all over the place in the world. This is just an example of that. Graham Cluley, who is a well-known security blogger, provided some nice coverage for a story that many outlets picked up. CNN, he quotes at one point, and this is from a presentation that Charles Henderson of IBM gave at the RSA conference recently. He's the global head of X-Force Red at IBM. Graham wrote, not too long from now, it will be pretty much impossible to purchase a new car which is not connected to the internet in some fashion. Many modern purchasers are more swayed by the gadgetry, bells and whistles their car includes than its performance. And with a world where everything seems to have an associated smartphone app, why should vehicles be any different? If most new cars, he writes, are going to be internet-enabled, then you know what that means. Yep, secondhand cars are going to be increasingly smart as well as vehicles sold on after a few years. I don't know how that parses. He says, as I'm writing on We Live Security, it should go without saying that it also means security threats. This point was brought home last week at the RSA conference in San Francisco, where IBM's Charles Henderson described how, over 2 years after he had traded it back in to the original authorized dealer, he was still able to access his old car via a smartphone app. Despite deauthorizing, and again, this is not a newbie. This is, you know, head of X-Force Red at IBM, at speaking at the RSA conference. Despite deauthorizing all associated accounts, satellite radio, garage door openers, resetting the Bluetooth, as well as surrendering all the keys at the time of sale. You know, so, you know, this guy, Charles Henderson, completely did everything he knew he could to divest himself of access to the car. He discovered that his mobile app never forgot his old car. The app allowed Henderson to track the geolocation of the car, adjust its climate control, send its sat-nav systems new directions, and even trigger its horn. But perhaps most alarmingly of all, the app also gave Henderson the ability to remotely unlock the vehicle. And this is 2 years after it was gone from him. Fortunately, writes Graham, the IBM researcher isn't one of the bad guys, but it's easy to imagine how a car thief or stalker would exploit such a feature. As Henderson explained to CNN, the car's new owners would have no clue that they were potentially at risk. Quoting him in his interview with CNN, the car, he said, is really smart, but it's not smart enough to know who its owner is. So it's not smart enough to know it's been resold. There's nothing on the dashboard that tells you the following people have access to the car. It turns out that although Henderson took more effort than probably most people in ensuring that he had wiped the car's knowledge of him and associated accounts before trading it in, that wasn't enough. As the researcher explains, that's because a full factory reset of the unnamed vehicle does not revoke access by the smartphone app. The information still lurks in the cloud and can only be wiped by a factory authorized dealer. One has to wonder, writes Graham, how often that occurs. Henderson's own investigation discovered four major vehicle manufacturers were allowing previous owners to access cars from a mobile app. This is the internet of insecure things at work again. In the rush to add bells and whistles, writes Graham, features are not being properly thought through, as we well know on this podcast, and security is not uppermost in manufacturers' minds. Until more effort is made by vendors to integrate the internet in a safe way into the myriad of devices that surround us, we're going to hear more and more stories of security breaking down like this. And it's like something I had never even occurred and never occurred to me that I don't know how you flush that. Maybe you delete the app and then reinstall it. But a lot of these apps, you know, they use the cloud to keep themselves synchronized. So a really interesting oversight on the fact of, as apparently four major car manufacturers are still allowing this to be possible. So I mentioned also that Chrome 56 has a UI update that took out a feature that I imagine many of our listeners would have appreciated or had appreciated in the past. It used to be that when you were at a secure site and you wanted to check the certificate, for example, you'd like to know if there's a man-in-the-middle attack or a middle box is filtering your connection. That is to say, is the certificate actually from eBay or Gmail or your bank, or is it from, you know, some manufacturer of a TLS intercepting proxy that's in your connection? The only way to know is to look at the certificate and see what it says. It used to be that you could click on the padlock in Chrome and you would get a little pop-up where it would give you the domain, and I did it to myself this morning, www.grc.com. Then underneath it says, your connection to this site is private. And then there it says details, which is a hyperlink. You click on that, and in all versions of Chrome prior to 56, that is up to 55, that then presents you with the certificate information. And that certificate information is the Windows UI under Windows, and it's the Mac UI on the Mac, because Chrome has traditionally used the existing secure infrastructure in the underlying OS to perform its TLS stuff. Well, the ability to do that is gone in Chrome 56. If you click on the padlock, you no longer have an option to view the certificate, which, again, they probably simplified it for most users. Maybe this is a consequence of some re-architecting of the way they handle security. I didn't take time to dig more deeply into this. You can still find it on all versions of Chrome 56 under the three dots or three bars menu. You go there and look under More Tools and then Developer Tools, and then click on the Security tab, which you may not even be able to find because it's way off to the right and it gets truncated with the little chevron. So you may have to click the chevron, then you'll find Security Overview. And then there is a View Certificate button. So they made it a lot more involved. For at least for Windows users, there's a shortcut, however, which is not documented anywhere that I could find, and that's Control-Shift-I. So for our listeners who tend to be certificate aware, if you are using Chrome 56 and later, Control-Shift-I, it still won't pop up the original convenient certificate display, but that jumps you immediately to the proper page, the security overview page in the developer tools area, and does allow you to pretty quickly get a hold of the certificate. So Control-Shift-I for some reason. So Firefox has been moving forward with their plan to evolve the browser. And over the year of 2017, they have a succession of updates planned, which take us from 51, where I am today, up to 57. And unfortunately, there are deliberate and side effect consequences to some of the things that they're going to be doing. They'll be putting the finishing touches during 2017 up through November on their plan, which they put in motion in 2015, to replace their original aging add-ons API. Theirs was an ad hoc, you know, their own system, which had the advantage of more flexibility than Chrome, than the Chrome approach. Chrome's system and the Chromium-based browsers, Chrome, Vivaldi, Opera, and others, they're based on a web extensions API. So the mixed blessing is Firefox has been moving to the web extensions API. But the existing Firefox extensions are not web extensions APIs. So as they move through this year to web extensions, as a consequence of other things they're doing, the ultimate upshot by the time we get to Firefox 57 in November is the entire existing Firefox add-ons ecosystem dies. which makes me nervous because, you know, for example, there are not yet equivalent extensions in Chrome that I depend upon and for Firefox. There are, you know, various workarounds and you know, largely they're the same. So the good, what Firefox gains from this, of course, is a single web extensions API that it will then share with the other Chromium-based browsers. So that's cool. That means that, well, and it's great for developers that then can only need to write one extension, which will then run not only on Chrome, but also on Firefox. So Firefox inherits the extension API of what has now become, with Chrome, the world's number one browser, which long-term is probably good for them. It does create some pain for we Firefox users who, in the meantime, our days are numbered, maybe, with some of our favorite extensions. We know that things like uBlock, Origin, that's already on Chrome, LastPass is already on Chrome, many things are. I really like my hierarchical tabs, and I know that there are a few tab solutions. Nothing that I've seen yet replaces what I've got on Firefox. So I can hope that maybe some of the existing add-on developers will choose to move their work over to web extensions, which would also give them access to the number one browser in the industry, which would be useful. So on Firefox 53, which is slated for release on April 18th, there will be no new legacy add-ons, as they call them, will be accepted any longer. So they'll support existing ones, but no new ones will be accepted at addons.mozilla.org. However, developers and users will be able to update pre-existing legacy add-ons, and Firefox will start running with multi-process support for most users. I tried to turn mine on, thinking, well, maybe that's a good thing, but it's been disabled by one or more of the legacy add-ons that I have. So that's one of the problems, is that there has been some conflict with the behavior of that Firefox brings with multiprocessor support and its incompatibility with legacy add-ons, which is one of the other reasons that they're beginning to move away. It's like, okay, they're just going to have to force the issue. So any Firefox add-ons that are confirmed as multi-process incompatible will be disabled in Firefox with Firefox 53 on April 18th. So this incompatibility is being flipped. Right now, the incompatible add-ons are able to disable the multi-process feature. With Firefox 53, it goes the other direction. Multi-process feature stays, and incompatible add-ons, they're disabled. So that's an important takeaway. Then over Firefox 54, 55, and 56, Firefox will be expanding its sandbox security features to incorporate multiprocessor support. And also expanding, right now that's only two process. You have sort of a UI process and then everything else. And that will be expanding from two to three and more processes in order to create more robustness and to deliver more performance. And then on Firefox 55, although there's no firm date set for that, the legacy add-ons will stop working due to this migrating change. And then finally, with Firefox 57, which is due to release on November 14th, that's the end of the line for old Firefox add-ons. If developers don't migrate their code from the old add-ons API to the new Web Extensions API by November 14th, their add-ons will stop working for good. So that means that with Firefox 57, it will only run add-ons built to the new Web Extensions API. For some reason, addons.mozilla.org will continue to list the legacy add-ons, but if you have been updating your Firefox and kept it current, it won't run them any longer. And they have not said at what point they will stop providing the legacy. Oh, there is one possible reason, and that is there are some of the Firefox derivatives, the derivative browsers, like Firefox ESR and Pale Moon, they may still provide a safe harbor for the legacy add-ons, and so you'd be able to get them for that reason from there. So Mozilla says that the reason old legacy add-ons will stop working in Firefox 57 is because they plan to remove from Firefox 57 a workaround that allowed non-multi-process code to run on the new Firefox engine. So it's just that's over at that point. And removing the workaround means that no code will run in Firefox if it hasn't been optimized for multiprocessor support. And at this point, it would be crazy for a legacy add-on developer to update their add-on. They might as well just recode for the Web Extensions API, which, again, it's somewhat more limited. There are some things that it cannot do, which may end up being restrictive for the sake of security, and so not a bad thing anyway. So anyway, a little bit of a bumpy road for the next year. At this point, my problem with Chrome is that it's just so memory hungry, and I'm still operating within a 32-bit, 4-gig, actually 3-gig under Windows constrained address space. So with Chrome burning up as much memory as it does, I'm still, you know, using Firefox and happy to do so. But I know that we have a lot of Firefox users among us, and so I wanted to let everybody know what the future looks like for 2017 in Firefox.
Do you mind if we take a little time out here?
Perfect.
Because you're going to the clipboard next, and that's going to take a while, I'm sure.
Yep.
Our show today brought to you by ZipRecruiter. If you're doing the hiring in your little neck of the woods, your enterprise, you want to know about something that's going to make it a lot easier and something you can do for free right now? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter. We use ZipRecruiter. It's awesome. What is ZipRecruiter? Well, it's kind of like a job board, but with one key additional feature. When you post to ZipRecruiter, it also goes to 200-plus job boards and social networks like Facebook and Twitter. One click of the mouse, and you're now reaching the most possible applicants. And presuming that the key person that you're really trying to find is somewhere out there, you don't know where, this helps you find that needle in a haystack by spreading the word, getting the word out there. There's better than that, though, because once you get those applicants rolling in, they're not going to go to your inbox or call your phone number. They're going to roll into the ZipRecruiter interface. No, they take the resumes, they format them so they're uniform. It's easy for you to read. They have screening questions. You can have questions with yes-no answers or multiple choice or essay, whatever makes it work for you. You then can review the resumes, review the screening questions, eliminate the wrong person, and hire the right person fast. It makes it very simple to process a whole bunch of candidates and get right to the person you want. No more juggling emails. No more calls to your office. ZipRecruiter has been used by the Fortune 100. It's used by literally a million plus businesses, medium and small. We've used it, and I highly recommend it. And I said you could use it for free. You can. You go to ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Really, it's just a way to get you to try it, because once you do, I know you're going to be just a happy customer forever. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. ZipRecruiter.com/twit. Steve Gibson, Leo Laporte. We're talking security and the Windows clipboard.
So, okay. Earlier this year, a Norwegian MVP, Oddvar Mo, made a rather shocking discovery that went mostly under the radar. He found that on Windows 10, there is a way to easily read clipboard contents, that is, you know, the system's global clipboard, from the screen of a locked machine without requiring any form of authentication. So this is a problem. In any enterprise environment, any coworker could easily go through a bunch of PCs at lunchtime, harvesting potentially juicy information, such as passwords, without leaving any traces. So how do you do this? It's pretty simple. You know, the WinL locks the workstation. So imagine, you know, so you can imagine employees locking their workstation with WinL and then going off to lunch. Well, from the lock screen, WinEnter starts the narrator. Then Caps Lock F1 opens Narrator Help, and Control V pastes the clipboard into the narrator and exposes
it starts the contents. Reading you the clipboard.
Yes.
Wow. All of this without unlocking.
All of this without unlocking. In the write-up, it said this can also be achieved through the Wi-Fi selector UI on the lock screen. So there are a couple ways to do this. And it not only affects Windows 10, but it's confirmed to be effective on 8.1. According to Oddvar, Microsoft does not consider this to be a security issue because it requires physical access. Okay. So there are some mitigations, and I have a solution for our listeners. Possible mitigations include disabling these features through the appropriate group policy settings or using a cute little utility called ClipTTL. And as we know from our discussion of the internet and packets, TTL often stands for time to live, as is the case here. It's a small utility written by Firas Salem to protect against this and other cases of accidental clipboard pasting. And since it is the case often that the clipboard can contain some sensitive information, because we use it as a little transport carrier from one place to another, clipboard TTL is an automatic clipboard wiper which prevents accidental or malicious pasting. Now, Firas is a Brussels, Belgium-based security consultant whose work we've covered before. He also wrote that RCC utility, which many of our listeners were interested in because it finds potentially rogue certificates in Windows and Firefox. It looks for any certificates that are not part of the baseline installation. So he's at trustprobe.com. I've got the links in the show notes. The utility that automatically wipes your clipboard after a set amount of time is ClipTTL. But there has been some additional people saying, what was that utility that lets me audit my trust store? And that's RCC, also by the same guy. And in fact, he's got a whole bunch of interesting bits of freeware that are, you know, sort of related and in this environment that I would recommend people check out. He's a good guy.
That's why LastPass somehow, and I don't know how it does this, it's kind of magical.
Yes.
Allows one and one only paste, right? It
correct.
Clears the clipboard after you paste.
Yes, it does. And
it's
caught me out a couple times.
Yeah.
Where it's like I was assuming it would I needed it still to be
times,
there.
Right.
Yeah, like for example, I would have it generate a password, put it on the clipboard, then I would paste it into a web app. But I also then wanted to make my own private copy.
Right.
And so I'd go over and open Notepad and try to paste it, and it was gone. It's like, ooh.
There must be a command or some sort of pasteboard command that does that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There is. Well, for example, if you've ever exited an app and you'll get a pop-up from Windows saying,
we're going to clear the clipboard.
The app that you've closed just left a whole bunch of stuff there.
That's embarrassing.
It's like, no, I don't want that.
No.
Get rid of that, please. No.
Yep. There's a
show. On November 16th of 2016, a little over 90 days ago, a problem was reported to Microsoft. And again, I don't know what's going on up in Redmond, but this was Project Zero gave Microsoft and confirmed receipt of formal notice of a worrisome problem that had been found, actually a number of worrisome problems, in a commonly used API known as Set DI Bits to Device. That's a friend of mine, that API. I used it way back in the days of 16-bit Windows when I wrote Chromazone. That you know, crazy screensaver toolkit app that is what I used to teach myself the Windows API, and I was using it just recently. Set DI bits, DI stands for device independent bits, and it's a way of supplying bitmap information to a device. And for example, like a way of programmatically drawing a bitmap. I use it in Squirrel, for example, in order to display the QR codes for transfer between devices. It's a way for me to take an algorithmically generated binary QR code and display it. You set DI bits to device. Well, it turns out that the ever-present meta file, speaking of honey monkeys and the very early episodes of this podcast, we covered that the controversial escape, which I'm convinced Microsoft originally had in the Windows meta file on purpose, but then a decade later, it didn't look nearly as benign as it originally did when security wasn't such an issue. Well, it turns out that after metafiles, we got enhanced metafiles, and metafiles are essentially interpreted API calls. So when you process a metafile, you are actually reading the API and its parameters. So what the Project Zero guys discovered was that there were some mistakes in the verification of parameters to the set DI bits to device API, and actually a number of others. So that was on November 16th, 2016, Microsoft was informed. Well, last Tuesday, February 14th, which was supposed to be Patch Tuesday, but as we know, wasn't for whatever reason, that was the 90-day expiration on the Project Zero timer. And all the details of this went public on last Tuesday. So the proof of concept, so what went public is a full documentation of the problem, including a proof of concept, which demonstrates.
I can just see them at Microsoft ready to push the button on the update. This comes out and said, did you know about this? I think he told us, didn't he?
I mean, it almost feels like a communication screw-up.
It must be. They ignored it for 3 months.
Yes. Yes. It's not a hard problem. So reading from this, the proof of file concept, while file attached here, they say in their disclosure, consists of a single EMR_setDIBitsToDevice record. So excluding the enhanced metafile header and end of file records, which originally contained a 1x1 bitmap. the dimensions of the DIB, the device independent bitmap, were then manually altered to 16 by 16 without adding any more image data. As a consequence, the 16 by 16, 24 bits per pixel, which is to say 3 bytes per pixel bitmap, is now described by just 4 bytes, which of course is no longer necessary. It needs, what is it? 16 by 16 is going to be 256. 3 bytes, that's 768 bytes. But the API only gives it 4, which they say is good for only a single pixel. The remaining 255 pixels will be drawn based on data from the heap, which may include sensitive information, such as private user data or information about the virtual address space. The author of this said, "I have confirmed that the vulnerability reproduces both locally in Internet Explorer and remotely in Office Online via a .docx document containing the specially crafted EMF file." So what this means is that the abuse of this API allows private data from the heap to be turned into an image, which can then be captured and exported. So this is not good, and it's been public for a week. And Microsoft will be updating this and hopefully fixing this in March. So until then, good luck to us. And wow, it's all public now.
Yeah.
Project Zero, also having been busy, spent some time looking at the Windows NVIDIA driver. Oliver Chang posted a nice little summary saying, "Modern graphic drivers are complicated." Yeah, indeed. "And provide a large promising attack surface for what he writes EOP, which is elevation of privilege, execution opportunities, and sandbox escapes from processes that have access to the GPU, such as the Chrome GPU process. In this blog post," he writes, "we'll take a look at attacking the NVIDIA kernel mode Windows drivers and a few of the bugs that I found." 16. He says, "I did this research as part of a 20% project with Project Zero, during which a total of 16 vulnerabilities were discovered." And I won't go through them all because they've been fixed. And in fact, they were fixed impressively. NVIDIA's response, describing NVIDIA's response, he wrote, "The nature of the bugs found show that NVIDIA has a lot of work to do. Their drivers contained a lot of code which probably should not be in the kernel, and most of the bugs discovered were very basic mistakes. One of their drivers, nvstreamkms.sys, also lacks very basic mitigations, for example, like stack cookies, even today." So, you know, a lack of even automated security mitigations that could have easily been turned on with a proper compilation. "However, their response," he writes, "was mostly quick and positive. Most bugs were fixed well under the deadline. And it seems, and we're unlike Microsoft's, and it seems that they've been finding some bugs on their own internally. They also indicated that they've been working on re-architecting their kernel drivers for security, but we're not yet ready to share any concrete details." So he concludes saying, "Given the large attack surface exposed by graphics drivers in the kernel and the generally lower quality of third-party code, it appears to be a very rich target for finding sandbox escapes and elevation of privilege vulnerabilities. GPU vendors should try to limit this by moving as much attack surface as they can out of the kernel." And of course, this has been a constant refrain of ours. One of the arguably, in retrospect, worst things Microsoft did was to move GDI, the graphics device interface, from user land, from being a DLL in user mode, where it was subject to the same restrictions as the programs which invoked it. Unfortunately, back at a time when processors were having a hard time keeping up and Microsoft graphics performance was lackluster, Microsoft decided, okay, there's just too much ring transition between GDI and the kernel, so they moved GDI into the kernel. And that's the reason that, for example, we've then had all of these problems with graphics vulnerabilities where a JPEG can take over Windows. It's because the JPEG is being interpreted in GDI, which is now in the kernel, which makes any escape from GDI subject to having, you know, ring zero root privileges, essentially. So what they should have done is kept it out in user land, in which case even if you did find a problem, it would be like a bug in the user software rather than a bug in the kernel. So anyway, it would be great if, again, it's just sort of, the problem is it's easier to keep it all as one lump and just stick it all in the kernel. The problem then is all of that code has to be perfect. If instead you go to the effort of bifurcating this job so that the only code in the kernel is what has to be there, then you keep most of the bulk of the work in the user in the user space, where it's subject, or it's under ring three and subject to all of the protections that our state-of-the-art hardware provides. So anyway, we'll hope that this is growing pains, but I was impressed with NVIDIA's response. They jumped right on it and they fixed all 16 problems. I did see a summary of them and scanned them, and they were just like fix, right down the line, and did so quickly. And they said that they're working to make things better. So I have a treat for our listeners. TOC.cryptobook.us. That'll take you to the table of contents of a 580-page tour de force, freely downloadable PDF graduate course in applied cryptography. We've talked about Victor Shoup in the past. He's a professor of security and cryptography at New York University. And Dan Bone is a professor of computer science and electrical engineering at Stanford. He's also the co-director of the Stanford Computer Security Lab. These two profs are authoring this book. It is at 0.3 version, not yet finished, but already really comprehensive. Describing it in its preface, they said, "Cryptography is an indispensable tool used to protect information and computing systems. It's used everywhere and by billions of people worldwide on a daily basis. It's used to protect data at rest and data in motion. Cryptographic systems are an integral part of standard protocols, most notably the Transport Layer Security, TLS protocol, making it relatively easy to incorporate strong encryption into a wide range of applications. While extremely useful, cryptography is also highly brittle. The most secure cryptographic system can be rendered completely insecure by a single specification or programming error. No amount of unit testing will uncover a security vulnerability in a crypto system. Instead, to argue that a crypto system is secure, we rely on mathematical modeling and proofs to show that a particular system satisfies the security properties attributed to it. We often need to introduce certain plausible assumptions to push our security arguments through. This book is about exactly that. constructing practical crypto systems for which we can argue security under plausible assumptions. The book contains many constructions for different tasks in cryptography. For each task, we define a precise security goal that we aim to achieve and then present constructions that achieve the required goal. To analyze the constructions, we develop a unified framework for doing cryptographic proofs. A reader who masters this framework will be capable of applying it to new constructions that may not be covered in the book. Throughout the book, we present many case studies to survey how deployed systems operate. We describe common mistakes to avoid, as well as attacks on real-world systems that illustrate the importance of rigor in cryptography. We end every chapter with a fun application that applies the ideas in the chapter in some unexpected way. So, and it goes on. Well, then the book goes on for 580 pages. I browse through it. Everything is there. Symmetric crypto, public key, hashes, you name it. It is, over the years, many of our listeners have asked for recommendations of books. And of course, Schneier's Applied Cryptography is still the Bible, but it's not free. This one is. Not finished. I think they said they have three major parts, and they have all of parts one and half of part two finished. But what's there already is very comprehensive and worthwhile. So again, TOC dot, it's got its own domain, toc.cryptobook.us. And there's a link there that will take you to crypto.stanford.edu where you can find it. So links are in the show notes. The show notes are already posted publicly at grc.com/sn. I've got the header for this episode, 600, is already there with a link to the show notes. So everybody should be able to find it without any trouble. And it looks great. So if anyone is looking for something to just browse through casually or to really roll up your sleeves, I know that from the past, a lot of our listeners are interested. This looks like the place to go. And this thing is only going to get better with time as the profs continue to flesh it out. And this one, it had a 0.1, 0.2, and 0.3. This 0.3 was just released in December of 2016, so a few months ago. And they're working on finishing it. Looks like it's going to be a nice piece of work. And they did note, I didn't describe it, but that there is a deliberate hierarchical nature. That is, you can skip the proofs. You can skip a lot of the formalism and still get a lot out of it just by reading sort of the introductions to each section and the goals of the various algorithms without getting down into the weeds. The weeds are there, but you don't need to bother with them. And they explicitly have written it this way so that there is a softer, gentler side. It's not just for people who want to do formal proofs for crypto. There is a sort of an upper layer that will still give you a lot. And I wanted a couple PF Sense and Ubiquity follow-ups. I got a tweet from a Dan Mutal, whose Twitter handle is Scruffy Dan. He said, listening to this week's Security Now, he said, and the Edge Router also allows you to restrict UPnP by IP address. Now, that's something I didn't know, so I wanted to share that. We've talked about the Ubiquity Edge Router X, which we like so much because it is a true router with independent ports where each port can be its own subnet, which allows you to, for example, create an IoT region. We were talking about, last week I talked about how PFSense, part of the UPnP UI on PFSense, absolutely has UPnP ACLs, access control lists, to allow you to explicitly restrict what ranges of IP or specific devices on your LAN have access to universal plug and play, because you really don't want that to be to give blanket permission. You'd rather only provide it where you have to. In fact, back when we were having connection problems, not, it turns out, due to anything we were doing, but because the relay server at Microsoft was bogged down that afternoon, one of the things that I did was thinking, well, maybe Skype now requires UPnP. It certainly would like to have it. Even though I had manually statically mapped a port and given Skype permission to use that statically mapped port, I thought, okay, well, maybe it's not using that anymore and it needs to use universal plug and play. So I for that reason, enabled universal plug and play, but only permitted the machine that I use Skype on for this podcast to have access to it. So, you know, again, I'm practicing what I'm preaching here. The point is that Dan brings up is that if you do have a Ubiquiti Edge router, as many of our listeners now do, because it's $49 and a great bargain for that price, you do need to use the command line interface. It's not surfaced in the web UI, but the capability is there. He says you need to use the CLI and the UPnP2 service to create the UPnP ACL. And the router is so popular and there's so much stuff on the net that I'm sure users, if you Google for UPnP2 service, UPnP ACL, Ubiquiti Edge router, you'll probably be able to find some how-tos and guides and things to help you with the command line interface. But the point is, it's in there, and that would allow you, without any additional hardware, to just use the Ubiquiti Edge Router X and enable UPnP for those devices on your network that need it. Somebody else tweeted, asked, what was the name of the new pfSense box that you mentioned on SN599 last week? And he said, I don't think you mentioned the name, just that it had two ports. And so that is the SG, I'm sure no relation, -1000. So if you go to pfSense under products, you'll find the cute little two-port box. The two-port router that is running pfSense. It's $149. What I don't know, and I didn't dig in, is what its bulk throughput is. That is, it does have a pair of gig interfaces, so a gig link to your upstream DSL or cable modem or wherever you're getting your bandwidth from, and a gig link then probably to a switch, which would then fan out to go to an access point and other things. The beauty is that this cute little thing, I mean, it's like the size of a matchbook. I mean, it's just big enough to hold two 10 base T Ethernet connectors. So it's very cute and tiny and very low power. The beauty of it is it's running pfSense, which, as we know, I mean, that's the universal toolkit for this. I mean, you can run proxies, you can run, OpenVPN, OpenVPN VPNs. I couldn't figure out if I was missing another word there. VPNs for point-to-point links, and just, you know, any other kind of security, full firewalls, traffic shaping, bandwidth limiting, rate limiting. I mean, it's everything you could want. The question is, will this little box actually run your data at a gig? Now, it doesn't really have to unless you have a gig upstream bandwidth. But will it run it at 300 megabits? I just don't know. So it's one thing to have the links capable of a gig, but the question is, what is the packet rate throughput through it. That I don't know. But that's what it is. It's the SG-1000 for $149 from netgate.com, which is where the pfsense.org page for their products takes you when you click on it. A beautiful little machine. And finally, someone tweeted, "Hi, Steve, I'm listening to SN599. You can use the Ubiquiti Edge Router X with the small PF Sense box for network segmentation." And so that's another point that I hadn't made. I was talking about using that with a VLAN aware switch, because the PF Sense box certainly has full support for VLANs, virtual LANs. And what that essentially means is that different ranges of IPs could be tagged as members of VLAN 1, VLAN 2, VLAN 3. Then when that goes to a VLAN aware switch, you want to make sure that a little dumb switch is VLAN aware, then it would perform the network segmentation. So this person was tweeting to me, he just observed that the Ubiquiti Edge Router X will also support network segmentation. So I wanted to make sure everyone knew that too. So we're ending up with a nice little, not very expensive toolkit of components that allow us to structure a very robust and safe network. A number of listeners reminded me of minilock.io. And this followed up from our conversation, Leo, last week about PGP and
ESCrypt.
And GPG and Keybase.
Yeah.
Right. They reminded me that I had talked about Minilock some time ago, because it was originated by our friend Nadim Kobayashi, who did CryptoCat. And then did Minilock.io. It's audited, peer-reviewed, and following on from what you said, Leo, and that is the notion that public key crypto makes much more sense for sharing encrypted content than symmetric key crypto. And you're right. This provides a simple means to do that. It is available as a Chrome add-on. So anyone with the most popular browser in the world, Chrome, can easily use this. It uses your email and a secret passphrase to generate what they call a Minilock ID. Minilock IDs are small because it also uses the Bernstein curve, the curve 255.19, which allows us to use much shorter and more convenient keys than the normal traditional RSA public key crypto allows, at the same level of security. So it makes them easy to share online. So anyone can use your ID, which again you generate with your email address and secret passphrase, to encrypt files to you. That is, encrypt them for your eyes only, and only you who have the matching private key to your Minilock ID, which is essentially your matching public key, then are able to decrypt them. So it's been audited. Matthew Green in Maryland, right? That's where Matt Green is?
Yeah, he said Johns Hopkins in Maryland.
Johns Hopkins, right. He's gone over it and was involved and helped with this. It's been audited independently and peer-reviewed, developed by experts, and so on. So, for example, the user flow would be, we have the typical roles in crypto, Alice and Bob. Alice wants to send a scan of her passport to Bob. Sending it over email would compromise her personal information. So Alice decides to first encrypt the scan using Minilock. Bob opens Minilock and enters his email address and his own personal secret passphrase. MiniLock displays his MiniLock ID, which is tied to and actually generated from his passphrase and is persistent. He sends Alice his MiniLock ID, which is a relatively short ASCII string, and he can tweet it to her. He can email it to her. It can be sent over a public channel. Does not need to be kept secret, because all that is his public encryption key, essentially. Alice drags and drops her passport scan into MiniLock, which again is a Chrome extension, and enters Bob's MiniLock ID as the recipient. She clicks the encrypt button and sends the resulting .minilock file to Bob. Once Bob drags the encrypted file into MiniLock, it automatically detects it as a MiniLock encrypted file destined to Bob and decrypts and saves the passport scan on his computer. So no third-party software, just uses Chrome, uses Curve 25519, for short and tweetable keys, and is a superior way to send encrypted content between two people who both have Chrome. So thank you to our listeners for reminding me that we talked about this once before, and I just forgot to bring it up again last week.
I just did it. It's great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool. Also, last week was our title was HTTPS Insecurity, and the link that I tweeted, and I don't think I had it in the show notes, or maybe I did. I think I had it in the show notes, but it turns out that the document disappeared, and a whole bunch of people – actually, I was very impressed with how many of our listeners wanted to dig deeper and follow up. And they weren't able to because the document was gone. So it's back. When I saw that, I grabbed it while I still had a copy from my own reading of it last week. So I stuck it up on GRC and tweeted it a few days ago. It is also now in the show notes. So anybody who isn't in Twitter or missed my tweet can, in this week's show notes down here in the notes, is the link to grab that paper if you're still interested. And then we have two little bits of lighter side. So we have a riddle. Why are assembly programmers always wet?
Why, Steve?
Because they work below sea level.
Oh, jeez. With a letter C, obviously, yeah.
That's right. Yes, we do. And then the follow-on funny picture of the week, if you're a little geeky, is a photo that shows how computers are made in our show notes.
I guess I should show that, huh?
I think you should. Yes. Just so that it's...
Because you can't really describe it, can you?
No.
You really... You had to see it to be there. And if you're listening on audio, just download the show notes. Steve puts... Steve tweets the URL out every week at SGGRC, or you can go to grc.com/securitynow and get the show notes, and you'll see the image.
And I did tweet this in my feed a few hours ago. Oh, okay. I got a lot of people thought it was fun and funny.
It's a small IC and some resistors with squiggly tails. That's all.
That's right. Yeah. Use your imagination.
Yep.
Under the picture is a link to the full size original image, which is really large. So anybody who wants a high resolution copy, you are welcome to it.
Funny. Resistance is fertile.
Oh, that's really good.
Chickenhead 21 gets credit for that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And I have a quick note to share from a Bob McKinstry in St. Louis, Missouri. He wrote, "Hey, Steve, I'm a listener of Security Now since year one, so 12 years, and a SpinRite owner. A few days ago, one of the residents in our training program asked how he could get help with his Dell laptop, as our IT department does not support machines they don't own. The story is classic. After a power outage, his laptop would not boot into Windows. it would blue screen, reboot, rinse, and repeat. Without hesitation, I told him about SpinRite. I lent him my trusty SpinRite CD, told him he'd have to purchase SpinRite if it did fix his machine. I told him he had to be patient and let the program do its work. So he fired up SpinRite and went to bed. When he woke in the morning, he was good to go, just like that. SpinRite, he writes, is a great product. Another drive saved. Another happy customer. Thanks for all that you do with GRC, and thanks for all the great podcasts that you've done with Leo on the Twit Network. And Bob, thanks for sharing your success.
That's awesome. Let's take a break. Then we're going to talk about this MMU side channel attack.
Everybody,
get your propellers ready.
Get your coffee. Get ready. Stop chewing and walking.
Maybe you want to take a short nap before you listen to the rest of the show. I don't know. I want you to be fully clear.
Maybe a long nap.
Prepared, or a long nap.
A long nap.
A long nap is the case, maybe.
Off a short pier.
Resistance is fertile. Our show.
Oh.
I don't know how he got that one. That's good. Our show today is brought to you by IT Pro TV. I don't have to tell you about IT Pro TV. I'm sure you remember our conversations from before. It's a really great place to go if you want to become an IT professional and you need to get those certs. Because, you know, if you don't have a job, a lot of times getting that first job means somehow proving that you have the skills, the certifications do it. And there are a lot of IT certifications. But I think a lot of IT pros who have work watch ITPro.tv religiously because it's fun, for one thing. But more than that, IT Pro TV keeps you up to date on every aspect of IT. You can watch it on your computer, on your tablet, but they also have Chromecast, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV apps, too. In fact, the new Apple TV app's awesome, which means you can put it on your big screen, then get in your car and listen on the road, then get to work, listen on the computer. And if you have it running in the background, and they're live Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern, you're going to learn just by osmosis. And, man, do they cover all the topics you want to know about. Certified Information Systems Security Professional, CompTIA Project Plus, Networking Plus, Ethical Hacking Version 9. You can get that Certified Ethical Hacker cert. AWS Solutions, Pen Testing. You've got transcripts of all the courses, so it's easy to follow from start to finish. They're really professionally produced. In fact, you know, they've got actually a better setup than we do. Their new studios are spectacular. There's Don Pezet, who is one of the trainers. He's one of the founders too, along with Tim Broom. Take advantage of their low cost monthly subscription price. Their no hassle cancellation policy. Normally, premium membership's $57 a month, which is, I think, very reasonable, especially when you compare it to a technical college, and even when you compare it to the kind of the study materials that a lot of these places, even at a bookstore, you'd spend more than that. $570 a year, you get 2 months free. But we got a special deal just for you. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/security now and use the code SN30. SN30 to save 30% off, not just for the first year, but forever. Now, let me tell you some of the additional benefits. Besides watching the shows, you get practice tests from Transcender. That's worth $109 by itself. Virtual machine labs. All you need is an HTML5 browser. You don't even need Windows or Windows Server to set up a server and configure a network. All of that can be done in the labs. They are just great. You're going to learn so much. You're going to have so much fun doing it. They've even got a chat room going on in the background just like we do. Now, I've got to warn you, IT Pro TV is about to announce a new membership level. If you join now, take advantage of this offer. As a premium member, you'll be granted the highest membership level available when this new pricing starts. So don't wait. Sign up today. itpro.tv/security now. Look at all the courses you can take. If you want to go there right now, you can even watch some sample videos. And they have an account you can watch live anytime for free. So if money's tight, and I know if you're looking for work, it probably is, this is a great way for free to get the kind of education you need to get a great gig. itpro.tv/security now. All right, Steve Gibson, time to talk. What is MMU?
That's the memory management unit.
Ah, okay.
Yes. So we do have, I got a tweet while you were telling us about IP Pro TV,
yes,
from Mike Roberts, who also had something clever to add. He said, "Who said resistors are passive?"
All right.
Because, of course, unlike a transistor, resistors and capacitors are considered passive components. But,
oh, man, that's geeky.
Nah, these resistors are they're getting busy, as they say. Okay, so the press coverage of this. I won't embarrass the specific magazines or the specific websites by calling them out. But one's headline was, "A chip flaw strips away a key hacking safeguard for millions of devices." No, it has nothing to do with a chip flaw. These guys have figured out how to very cleverly leverage a fundamental operational characteristic of all modern processor architectures to penetrate the randomization of all address space layout. ASLR. Another one wrote, "New ASLR busting JavaScript is about to make drive-by exploits much nastier." No, it doesn't make them nastier. It makes them significantly more possible and likely. Someone else, one of the other major coverages was, "JavaScript breaks ASLR on 22 CPU architectures." No, it breaks it on all contemporary CPU architectures. In one of the papers they did, they applied some of their research to 22 different CPU architectures, but that's all the ones they had around. So until something changes, this thing just busts it. And finally, "A simple JavaScript exploit bypasses ASLR protections on 22 CPU architectures." It says a simple JavaScript exploit. There's nothing whatsoever simple about this. Now, I hope I didn't scare everyone away my admonitions at the top of the show to not try to walk and chew gum while listening to this. It's not that crazy. But these guys are. As I mentioned, this is the group at the University of Amsterdam who gave us, and we covered in episode 576, Flip Feng Shui. And our listeners since then will remember that they came up with a sublime, is the word I used at the time, a sublime hack where they were able to leverage the fact that virtual machine environments consolidated identical pages of virtual memory in order to share pages that were the same. They figured out a way to use the bit flipping of Rowhammer in order to get a shared page with sensitive information from an adjacent running VM. And that was Flip Feng Shui that we described. Then later in episode 583, they gave us DRAMMER, which was a new attack exploiting Rowhammer on Android devices and essentially cut through all of the Android devices that had been looked at. There were some newer ones had some mitigations against it, but in general, it was devastating at the time. This one, there are some potential mitigations we'll talk about, but again, this is just sublimely clever. So in the show notes, I've got links to the two research papers that back this up. I don't think these links will be ephemeral as the one from last week was. So they're linked on their site. They have a history of keeping these things present in into the future. If they do go away, I can provide them, but I'd rather that people went there. So their site is www.vusec.net/projects/ANC. That's the short name of this attack, ANC. Okay, so what they've got, and I'll explain exactly how it works, is a working means to allow arguably the sloppiest, least low-level code that we use, namely JavaScript in a browser, to determine the virtual address of important regions of memory in the operating system, which is exactly what address space layout randomization is designed to hide, to obscure, and to prevent. Okay, there isn't a harder problem to solve than doing this in JavaScript. They have native code that can do it, and unfortunately, malware could take advantage of this if it wanted to also. So, I mean, this is a big deal. So, you know, the press coverage was wrong in the details, but right in the overall concept. And the bad news is, as we'll see, what this leverages is a low-level fundamental fact of the way our processors are designed on purpose, which leaks information in an exploitable way about where things are in the operating system's address space. And I don't know what's going to happen. There are mitigations that can be applied to the browser to make this less feasible, but there's nothing you can do at the low level. There's nothing you can do for native code running on the system, and I'll explain why. So backing up a little bit, address space layout randomization. One of the early mitigations for buffer overruns, which are such a problem, the idea with a buffer overrun was that an internet connected client, or even a JPEG, you know, anything that where an attacker had some way of providing data, whether as a fake image or as a packet to a server, if the hacker could provide data, that data would be accepted in some kind of buffer that you open the image, and so that JPEG file gets read into a buffer, or it's received over the internet. It goes into a communications buffer. What the early attacks were, they leveraged some means of executing that data, executing the data in the buffer. And so the first bright idea that occurred to people is, wait a minute, let's add a feature to the processors where segments of memory can be marked as no execute. That is, this you can put anything you want to in there, but you cannot set the processor's instruction pointer to an address in there. There will be a flag on that page of memory saying no, you know, execution is prohibited, and so it simply can't be executed. So that was called DEP, Data Execution Prevention, and that was good. And Microsoft, you know, gently moved us into it because we wanted to make sure that applications were DEP compatible. And so initially the OS used it, and then only parts of the OS, and then users could turn it on for specific applications. And we sort of, you know, we gradually adopted data execution prevention. And it was a good thing. So now attackers are prevented from providing their own data to somehow jump to and execute. But they're clever blokes, as we know. So they said, hey, you know, we can't provide our own code, but there's already a lot of code in the system. So what if we jump to the end of a subroutine that does a little bit of work and then comes back to us? You know, the way subroutines work, you normally jump in at the top of a subroutine, and where you came from is put on the stack. And when the subroutine exits, it pops the stack and returns to the instruction after the one that caused you to execute the subroutine. So it's sort of, so that's why it's called a subroutine. It's, you're doing something, you say, okay, go do this, and then come back to me when you're done. Well, what they realized was they may not want all of the subroutine does, but toward the very end, there might be something useful going on. So nothing makes you only jump in at the top. You can typically jump in anywhere. And we've talked about mitigations to prevent that, to allow only jumping to the top of subroutines. That there's work going on about that too. But so that's the way data execution prevention was worked around. It's like, okay, if you won't let us provide our own code, we'll just go jumping around in the operating system using code that's already there to get our work done. So then in this cat and mouse game, the next flash of mitigation was, the problem is the same code for a given OS is always loaded in the same place. You know, like when the OS boots, it loaded itself in at the bottom and everything else went on top. But we realized it didn't have to go at the bottom. There's nothing, because of the way memory management works, we could scatter the code around within the OS's virtual address space so that, and we could do it randomly so that every boot of the OS, every instance of booting all over the planet would end up just scattershotting the various modules of the operating system into random addresses. So now the hacker has a problem because there's code they may want to execute, but they don't know where it is. Now, there has been some interesting mistakes made by older APIs. Well, not even older APIs, but APIs that weren't written with this hide their own address problem. For example, there are APIs, I don't know, like functions you could call in the operating system where you say, give me a buffer containing something. And that function allocates in itself some buffer space and returns a pointer to the buffer. And in doing so, it gives up its own address. So there were APIs, there were functions that were leaking, that were found to be leaking their own addresses. And that was used for a while in order to get around the fact that ASLR randomizes where everything is. Okay, so that's where we were. We had data execution prevention, and then we added address space layout randomization so that code that was essentially blind, it came in and is running in the OS, and there's that boundary between it and the operating system where all it can ask is the operating system to do things for it, but it can't see where they're being done. So that was good news. Okay. These guys figured out a way around that. And thus the problem. Modern memory management units all modern architectures have it. This is this whole virtual memory versus physical memory thing. The idea being that there is a mapping between the virtual memory addresses and physical addresses, meaning that the instructions and the programs and the jumping and accessing and reading and writing what looks like physical memory may be physical memory, but the address you're using is a sort of a pseudo address, a virtual address, which the processor's hardware, the memory management unit, maps into physical memory. So, for example, 64-bit processors, contemporary 64-bit processors like the, you know, the Intel X64 family, they have a 64-bit virtual address space. Now, okay, because that is an insane memory space. Okay, remember 64 bits, 32 bits is the internet, right? So that's 4.3 billion. So 64-bit is, we already know, that's going to be 4.3 squared billion billion, which is something like 17 billion billion. Okay, that's more memory than anything's going to have for a long time. So Intel said, okay, we're not even going to bother with all 64 bits. We'll use 48. So on 64-bit Intel processors, the virtual address space is 48 bits. There is what's known as page level granularity, meaning that memory is allocated in pages, which happen to be 4K for various reasons. It's convenient. That's the typical cluster size on a hard drive. So when you need to load a page, you load a cluster. So 4K sort of was a nice size. 4K is 12 bits. That is, it takes 12 bits to address 4K. So in a 48-bit address, the lower 12 bits is the offset in the page. That is the 12 bits gives you 4K bytes. So it's the location, the byte location within the 4K page. So that's 12 bits out of 48, leaving 36 higher order bits. Those are broken into four sets of 9 bits. 9 bits, since 8 bits gives us 256 combinations, 9 bits gives us 512. So each of those four sets of 9 bits is considered a pointer into a system global page table. So the highest order 9 bits in of the 48-bit address, that actually is a pointer to a 512 entry table, which is the first page table, and its location is its absolute location and physical memory is pointed to by a register in the processor called CR3, Control Register 3. So the highest 9 bits is the offset into that table, which contains a pointer to the second level table, which the second most significant 9 bits provides the offset into. That entry points to the third level table, where the third most significant 9 bits provides the offset into that table, which points to a fourth level table, which the fourth and least most significant 9 bits of the upper 36 provides the offset to, which, believe it or not, finally points to the actual page in physical memory.
Does this, some of this go back to the memory segmentation of the early X86?
Yeah, it's like that on steroids to the power of infinity.
Because I remember when I was doing assembly language on the Motorola 68000, it was such a joy because the memory space was flat. It had big enough registers. You could directly address anywhere in the memory. You didn't have to do this, this segmentation thing.
Yes, and I, as a programmer of 16-bit code, a lot of SpinWrite still is 16 bits because everything I've been writing for the last couple decades has been 32 bits. So there's more and more 32-bit code coming into SpinWrite, but the original stuff had segments, and I was always having to be loaded
so
in the
annoying.
Segment. Oh, it is. And
but
so
why
me,
do they still do it? Their registers are 64-bit now. They could address all that memory easily, directly.
Yes. It's because you give the processes the illusion of 3 gigs or however much memory you want to, but many different processes are sharing it, and it doesn't actually exist.
Wow.
That's what a page fault is. A page fault is an attempt to map a page which is not currently in physical memory. And so that's where swapping comes from. So what happens is if that page is marked as swapped out, then the process thinks it has the memory and it's completely hidden from it. It says, give me this byte at this address. Well, so the processor looks up through this crazy 4-level hierarchy of page tables and goes, oops, we swapped that out last week. And you haven't asked, no one's asked for it recently. But it has a pointer to where it is. It reads it in to physical memory and then adjusts the page tables to point to that. So the code has no idea any of that happened. Oh, and the virtual memory manager, which is where that's going on, it's scrambling stuff up all over the place. Stuff's being swapped out, brought back in. Processors are being put to sleep and woken back up. So this is all – I mean, it's incredible that this all works. And, you know, it all works because it was developed carefully over time, and it's sort of a process of evolution, sort of like the human body. It's amazing that it all works as well as it does. So – So all of these levels of indirection, this 4 stages of hierarchy, provides a huge amount of flexibility to the operating system. But imagine the overhead. We're talking every single instruction fetch, every single data write or read has to be mapped through this system. Well, you couldn't get off the ground if there wasn't some way to speed that up. So the first thing there is something called TLBs, translation look-aside buffers. The TLB, it's got a funky name, translation look-aside buffer, but that's like the cache for all of that work. So the translation look-aside buffers provide a shortcut that maps virtual memory to physical memory so that you don't have to follow this four-layer linked list, essentially, in order to every single time you want to do anything with physical memory, whether it's execute an instruction or read or write data. The problem is there's only so much TLB space available. Processors are busy. And the TLB starts out empty in the beginning when you boot up. So it's only as a consequence of doing all of that fetching through all these crazy page tables that you end up maturing the TLB so that it's got a useful working set of mappings in order to convert virtual addresses to physical addresses. Okay, so if the TLB does not have the mapping, there is an LRU flush, a least recently used replacement policy, which so if an entry hasn't been used for a while, it gets pushed out of the TLB by what's been going on more recently. So that's, you know, standard caching logic. But if the processor looks through the TLB to hoping to find a match for the virtual memory range that it's having to do something with, anything with, execute an instruction, read or write data. If it doesn't find it, now it's like, oh crap, I need to do the lookup. So if it, now these page tables exist in main memory, and if there's anything we know about DRAM, it's not only can you hammer it, but it is slow. It is excruciatingly slow compared to the contemporary speed of today's processors, which have just shot ahead, you know, where, I mean, with dizzying speed, you know, what, 4.3 gigahertz, 4.3 billion cycles per second. Meanwhile, DRAM's technology has kept it back. So, you know, it's way faster than a hard drive, but it is agonizingly slow compared to the processor's appetite. So what's been developed is level 1, level 2, and level 3 caches. There are the level 1 cache is closest to the execution and data units, and it's actually split into level 1 instruction cache and level 1 data cache, meaning that instructions have their own level 1 cache and data reads and writes have their own. That's to prevent them, either one, from knocking the other one's data out of the cache. Then the level 2 cache is below the level 1 cache and feeds the level 1 cache, and that's shared between instructions and data, but both level 1 and level 2 caches are per core. So if you have a quad core chip, each of the four cores has its own level 1 data and instruction cache and level 2 cache. However, the entire chip of multiple cores shares a much larger, like on this, on the scale of 8 megs, level 3 cache on a large chip. Whereas, for example, the level 2 are more like 32K. They're big and very fast and accessible to the core. But level 3 cache, still on the chip, is more like 8 megs. And then that's the that's if it's not in the level 1 cache or the level 2 cache or the level 3 cache, then the system has to go out and ask for it from DRAM, which in pulling it into the chip puts, you know, it leaves it in the caches where it can then be found from there on. Okay, so if a mistake was made, a fundamental architectural mistake, it's that it never occurred to anyone, and I don't mean just Intel, because AMD has the same problem, call it a vulnerability, as does the ARM architecture. They all do this. The memory management unit with this crazy multiple hierarchy of page tables, in order to get the speed it needs, if the translation look-aside buffer has had its entry knocked out, uses the caches. It uses the same set of caches as the program. And that's the problem. What this means is that memory management unit activity, which is by design hidden from the code. That's all down in the OS. That's, yeah, you could argue it's even below the OS. It's in the hardware. But the point is, programs do not need to know their physical addresses. They see their virtual addresses, and they should not see them. It's hidden by design. But the mistake that every processor makes is that this memory management unit, for the sake of performance, is sharing the caches with executing processes. And we know how an executing process can determine if something is cached or not. If something is cached and it's able to time the to determine the length of time it took to get it, the cache is so much faster that it will get an almost instant answer. In fact, it is instant if the cache is close to the core. If it's not in the cache, it forces a DRAM read, which is measurably slower. So this allows operating code to probe what's in the cache and is not. And what these guys so cleverly figured out is that in is something as crude and coarse and granular and high level and interpreted, well, JavaScript is not as interpreted as it always is because we're trying to speed it up so much. But still, given the limited resources of JavaScript running in the browser, these guys figured out how to essentially use the fact that memory management was sharing the data cache of the code that was running in the browser to probe and reverse engineer the contents, the recent history of the memory management user's use, and, for example, determine the virtual address of the heap for the process, which is memory, which should otherwise have no known value. So we've talked about timing and the vulnerability of our systems to timing attacks in the past. And as a consequence, browsers, there were several attacks where the time required to decompress data was used by adding data to headers, JavaScript, and making lots of queries. JavaScript was able, by accurately measuring the time it took to perform this, was able to reverse engineer the contents of the unknown data, because the compression would compress the added data if it was the same as the unknown data, and that would change the length of the compressed result. And so very clever scripting was able, with enough queries, to figure out the unknown data compared to what was known. Browsers, years ago, in response to those attacks, which we covered on the podcast, they decided, okay, we're not going to give JavaScript super granular timing information. The browsers, both Firefox and Chrome, reduced the resolution of the API, which captures the current instant in time, from infinity. It used to be the resolution of the clock, so it was nanoseconds. They reduced it to 5 microseconds. So they deliberately removed resolution so that JavaScript could not determine as accurately as it originally could what time it was. So once again, not to be daunted, our clever engineers said, okay, fine. We don't have accurate timing, but is the 5 microseconds itself accurate? And it turns out that Chrome and Firefox differ a little bit. Chrome is a little trickier. They fudge the actual timing event. It still has 5 microseconds resolution, but they delay it a couple different amounts in order to further obscure the actual moment of that 5 microseconds event. Firefox didn't do that. So, for example, in Firefox, the way you solve this problem is you query the API until the timer ticks. So that gives you tick alignment. Then you perform the operation that you want to time, in this case, a read or a write of a certain location, because you're wanting to probe the cache. And as soon as you get control back from that operation, you start doing something, you start counting how many times you can go in a loop until the next timer tick. And so what happens is, essentially, the 5-microsecond resolution puts fence posts, and you perform you align yourself with one fence post at 5 microseconds, do something, and the moment you get back, you spin until the next fence post, until the next value, the next 5-microsecond tick occurs. And so the number of spins that you are able to accomplish, that allows you to infer by comparing them, by comparing cached and uncached counts of spin counts, essentially, whether the unknown timing was short or long. So that's one of the clever things these guys did. There's another approach using web workers, which are essentially extends the JavaScript API to a multi-threaded environment where you're able to say, you go off and do this. Well, what you tell – oh, and you also – the workers, in order to coordinate, they have a region of shared memory that they can both see. So the web worker – you give it the task of simply spinning up a counter in the shared memory as fast as it can. Now you have your own timer, which you're able to use, which is, again, much higher resolution than the deliberately blunted resolution of the JavaScript timer in order to determine how long something took to occur. So these guys worked around the deliberate timing blunting but the browsers added a JavaScript. They realized that because all the current processor architectures share a common cache, which is available to the operating code with the memory management unit, which they have to cache. Otherwise, the whole system would just come to a grinding halt. If the page tables were non-cached, nothing would ever get off the ground. But the problem is they could have been given their own cache. Instead, they shared that caching, which made good sense in terms of resource utilization for the processor, but it was a critical architectural mistake. In this context, if you absolutely do not want programs to know where stuff is, you can't let the programs have any visibility into the memory management. And as a consequence of the fact that page tables are stored in main memory and are cached in a common cache, which can be probed by timing-sensitive code, unfortunately, we no longer have the protection that ASLR was designed to provide. So bravo to these guys. And I don't know what this means. The browsers could further work to fudge things. But as I said, there's nothing you can do to prevent this at the native code level. So, I mean, that's really where the big problem is with, you know, malware that people download by mistake and are relying on system level protections to keep that code from being able to elevate its privilege to root or kernel level. This presents bypass opportunities. This is all in the public domain. It's open source. There's a bunch of utilities. These guys created both JavaScript and native code that demonstrates it. One of the papers is this 22 architecture demo that they provide, where they essentially did a generic memory mapping unit reverse engineering code, because these inner levels of detail don't need to be known by the software. So they're undocumented across these various chip families. The high level, how you talk to the memory management unit, everybody knows that. But the inner details are it's not that they're such a big secret, but it's like, well, it's just the hardware architecture. Nobody really needs to know how it's all wired together. To pull this attack off, you have to know. So these guys have a tool that allows them to reverse engineer, to reverse engineer and determine the exact sizing of every level of caching in the hierarchy and the nature of the cache replacement policies within the chips. Just a phenomenal, beautiful piece of engineering. And something that will probably drive some changes in the architectures of our chips moving forward. The bad news is there's nothing we can do about the entire install base of chips, of chip hardware that we have now. We're in for an interesting ride.
Not that once you get the memory table, the rest is cake.
Correct.
I mean, you have to inject code somewhere in that memory table. You have to figure out where the next jump is, that kind
correct.
Of thing.
Correct. Yes, and that's why I was critical in, for example, in Ars Technica, who said new ASLR busting JavaScript is about to make drive-by exploits much nastier. No, it's not. It makes them significantly more possible and perhaps more likely, because this has the potential for defeating address space layout randomization, which we really are depending upon.
Well, I mean, there's been other issues with ASLR. It often breaks things. Does everything use it now?
It's becoming very widespread.
Back in Windows 7, it was optional.
Yeah, they attacked Linux because Linux's ASLR is 28 bits of entropy, whereas Windows is only 28 bits in Linux. I think it's 24 bits in Windows. And so they tackled the harder of the two platforms, and they made this work both in Firefox and Chrome on Linux.
Wow.
Yeah, beautiful piece of work.
Yeah, it's quite elegant. That little timing thing.
Yep.
Very yep. Clever. Well, there you have it. Don't know what the upshot
everybody
is.
can start chewing gum again.
Take your propeller hats off, start chewing and walking, and it wasn't as bad as you said. Or maybe just because I've had to already wrap my head around address segmentation for so long.
Well, and remember, these things, as we know, exploits only get worse. They never get better.
Right.
And so this is a major wedge in a technology that to a large degree, a mitigation we've been depending upon.
Right, right.
Beautiful piece of work.
And you know, to be fair, we didn't have ASLR till recently. Right?
Correct.
So it's not like it's going to be back to the old days. It's not like everything's, you know. This is a relatively new technique to make you more secure. And there are other things protecting you, I would hope. Steve Gibson is at grc.com, and someday we're going to answer your questions, maybe even next week. So get them out and put them there at grc.com/feedback or tweet him at SGGRC. When you get to grc.com, you'll note many fine and fabulous things. Don't get too distracted by those until you buy a copy of SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. It's right there. Then, after that, you can try Shields Up and Perfect Paper Passwords, the password generator, read about Squirrel and the Healthy Sleep Formula. There's so much stuff there. grc.com. Also, this show, of course, 64 kilobit audio. Human written transcripts by Elaine Ferris, all at that site. We have audio and video at our site, twit.tv/SN. We also have a survey we'd love you to take, just a week left in the survey. So if you can get to it before the end of the month, it's take a couple of minutes of your time. twit.tv/survey lets us know a little bit more about you. In aggregate, we don't take any, you know, we don't want your personal information. We're not going to try to figure out who you are. We just want to know, well, what percentage is men? What percentage is women? What percentage have college educations? What's the income? And some of that's for us for programming purposes, but I think we know you pretty well for that. Mostly it's for us to tell advertisers because they always want to know that stuff.
Right, right.
Well, who's listening? I don't know. They're good people. Everybody, all the other advertisers like them. They want that stuff. And so it helps us a lot to monetize the network. And if we don't do that, well, we got no network. So twit.tv/survey, if you would, it really helps out. We have a we have caps now, by the way. We have Twit logo caps and twit.tv caps in the Twit store, twit.tv/store. We don't make a lot of money on it. It's not really a profit thing. It's more because, well, people have asked us. We want T-shirts. We want mugs. We want hats. Now we got really nice hats, actually. I'll wear one next time. That's at the Twit store, twit.tv/store. Steve, let's do this again. Maybe, I don't know, I'm thinking next Tuesday about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern.
How about for episode number 601?
601.
Yeah.
There's a good 600s. Yeah. Kind of a nice show, as always. Congratulations on 600. Well done. 12 years.
Okay, yes, in our 12th year. Okay, my friend, I will talk to you next week.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks. Security.